And Patricia is an assistant professor in the Department of Social and Behavioral Sciences at our University of California, San Francisco, UCSF. And her research focuses on the tobacco industry and tobacco control policy issues. To her left is Emily DeSante, who is a research officer at the Ontario Tobacco Research Unit at the University of Toronto, Canada. Emily has an MA in political science, and she is the project manager and a qualitative researcher for the Chatterbox Project. Emily's research interests include monitoring of tobacco industry marketing, cessation interventions, new methodological approaches to tobacco evaluation, and global health. And our third presenter will be Brianna Rago, who is a visiting scholar in the Department of History at Stanford University. She finished her PhD in History of Science at Stanford in 2012, and she also has a Master's in Geology, also from Stanford. And she is currently revising her dissertation on the history of the research department at Philip Morris, which will be a book project. Her work on the tobacco industry's research on polonium-210 in tobacco was published in Scientific American. And finally, we'll have Lissy Friedman, who is a senior staff attorney at the Public Health Advocacy Institute at Northeastern University School of Law in Boston, Massachusetts. She graduated from Suffolk University School of Law, and her areas of expertise include tobacco litigation and the tobacco industry's use of corporate social responsibility rhetoric and tactics. She's currently working on a grant from the National Cancer Institute studying the tobacco industry's use of personal responsibility messaging. I am so looking forward to this panel. Please, a round of applause for everybody for being here. And Patricia McDaniel will start us off.
Thank you. Good morning. I'd like to acknowledge my co-author, Ruth Malone, who was originally scheduled to give this presentation, but obviously I will be giving it instead. We have nothing to disclose. This presentation is based on a project that examines Philip Morris USA's internal exploration of corporate social responsibility practices and principles and its outcome. In the last decade, tobacco companies have embraced CSR as a way to improve their public image. This presentation explores how Philip Morris executives reconciled corporate responsibility principles with the company's history and the product's deadliness. And it's based on an examination of internal tobacco industry documents, approximately 150 Philip Morris documents. When Mike Szymanczyk became CEO of Philip Morris in late 1997, he concluded that the company was out of alignment with society's expectations of a socially responsible company. At the time, there were numerous state lawsuits seeking to recover Medicaid costs related to tobacco-caused disease, and public opinion of the tobacco industry in general was quite low. Szymanczyk quickly moved to reframe Philip Morris's mission from a singular focus on being successful to a focus on being responsible, effective, and respected. As part of this new framing, Philip Morris created a corporate responsibility department. It, in turn, created a task force to develop a corporate responsibility definition for Philip Morris and to recommend CSR-related policies and practices to senior management. And senior management included Mike Szymanczyk, the CEO, as well as 10 other senior vice presidents. The Corporate Responsibility Task Force was made up of 5 outside consultants who had worked with Philip Morris in the past, and 18 high-level Philip Morris employees who were selected by management for their, quote, progressive thinking regarding Philip Morris's mission. At the very first task force meeting in October 2000, Mike Szymanczyk outlined an ambitious goal for the task force. Our goal is to redefine the role of a corporation in American society, to deal with our product issues, and figure out how to deliver social value on a large scale. From the beginning, however, the Corporate Responsibility Task Force struggled with how Philip Morris did or could contribute social value, which it defined in early meetings as making the world a better place. The struggle over the question of social value was linked to what the task force called the big why. What was Philip Morris's purpose, its positive contribution to society, its reason for existence? And this was a difficult question to answer because, as a senior manager pointed out, creating social value starts with the product, yet except to the smoker, there is no perceived social value to our product, and smokers' perceptions may vary. So the group explored possible sources of Philip Morris's social value, the progress of changing for the betterment of society, a reduction in harm and pleasure, but was not satisfied with any of these. This task force struggle with the concept of social value was most clearly evident in the evolution of a statement of principles that summarized the company's responsibility commitments. An early draft had an extensive introductory paragraph that explained the task force's initial thoughts about social value. Corporations are citizens in their societies, impacting the environment, social relationships, communities, politics, health, and human development. We believe that for a corporation to be responsible, it must examine all of these impacts, engage in active discussions with stakeholders as to what responsibility means, and constantly review and adapt its activities to assure that it creates social value as well as economic value. After an initial review by senior management, this paragraph was removed. In the next draft, social value appeared only near the end of a list of responsibility-related goals. Philip Morris would strive to provide economic and social value to our shareholder, and by that they meant the parent company, Altria, to justify its confidence in us as a responsible and productive member of the company. And a notable addition to this draft of the Statement of Responsibility Principles was the pledge to conduct our business so that our policies and actions provide benefits for future generations. And this principle was removed after senior management review. So the final version of the Statement of Principles, which they now called our mission, and this was provided to all employees, did not refer to social value at all, but read simply that Philip Morris would strive to provide returns to our shareholder to justify its investment and confidence in us. Corporate Responsibility Task Force members also struggled with Philip Morris's past, specifically the company's history and the public's perception that we lied. They never explained in the notes exactly what they were supposed to have lied about, but it was presumably about the deadly and addictive nature of their products. Focus groups indicated that the public wanted an apology from tobacco companies. And task force members wondered, how do we reconcile with our perceived past to move forward? The task force discussed pros and cons of reconciling the past through an apology or an acknowledgement. Arguments in favor included the tremendous power that can come from the unification around healing and be directed toward creating the future. An apology offered a chance at closing the partially healed wound that is still easily opened. The task force also noted the potential for forgiveness. Our society does allow that one can make serious mistakes, even with the best of intentions. But an apology's emotional toll was unpredictable, making it difficult to compare the cost of an apology to that of saying nothing. A task force member also noted that there is a huge implicit promise that comes with an apology, such as specific changes in business practices that Philip Morris might not be prepared to commit to. Ultimately, the task force concluded that Philip Morris didn't need to apologize for the past. Instead, we need to connect the past to the present and future by telling our story. And one component of the story was the company's roots of responsibility. And these were examples of Philip Morris's responsible behavior as far back as 1954 in employee relations, education funding, philanthropy, sponsorship of women's sports, and community involvement. After reviewing these examples, a task force member concluded that once we start connecting all the pieces, it becomes clear that we've been doing a lot of really good things for a long time. Another pointed out Philip Morris's consistent, responsible intentions. This is a company that's always wanted to be responsible, but along the way, we had a disconnect with society's expectations of us. There was no further discussion of this period of disconnect, however. And despite seemingly concluding that Philip Morris was already a responsible company and didn't need to do anything else, the task force did ultimately consider new ways for the company to demonstrate its responsibility. And one of the more radical suggestions was to revolutionize the way we market and communicate. This might include changing the premise of our marketing to an opt-in approach, which would involve changing the presumption from advertise to all and some will choose to smoke, to advertise only to those who have made the informed adult choice to smoke, and build a business model based on the new presumption. Under this model, no Philip Morris branded tobacco marketing would appear in magazines with any youth readership, and point of sale displays in stores frequented by youth would be limited. Task force members also asked, what's the extra mile on warning and disclosure on or in packs, on ads? We need to know how to communicate risk so that consumers get it. Legal review of these meeting notes suggested that this last suggestion was unwelcome. A handwritten note from a company lawyer stated, "Our view is that current warnings are adequate and risks well known. Thus, it is not clear what this bullet adds, means, or that it's needed." And senior management appeared to have a similar reaction to the task force's other marketing ideas. They rejected the group's initial draft statement on marketing principles that pledged that Philip Morris would work constructively with public officials to assure that cigarette marketing is appropriate given its health risks and that marketing is minimally visible to minors. So they rejected that. And the final approved version distributed to employees was a far more traditional and vague pledge to responsibly market our brands to adults who choose to smoke. In July 2001, the task force completed its task, left these difficult discussions behind, and recommended three CSR priority area initiatives for the company to pursue, dealing with what it refers to as environmental tobacco smoke, reducing cigarette litter, and enhancing supply chain management. Currently, if you look at the Philip Morris website, it includes information on litter-related activities and promotion of sustainable agricultural practices. There's nothing on secondhand tobacco smoke. There continues to be no mention of social value in its mission statement, and Philip Morris has not apologized for lying to the public. Public demands for corporate social responsibility suggests that organizational legitimacy depends in part on sustaining a perception that a company contributes social value. Philip Morris's CEO seemed to recognize this in calling for the Corporate Responsibility Task Force to consider how Philip Morris might deliver social value on a large scale. As we saw, the task force failed in this task and failed to meet this very expansive goal. Its ultimate conclusion that the company's social value was its ability to provide shareholder return simply restates, as a social value, all corporations' standard fiduciary obligations to company owners. But the discussions highlighted here suggest that members of the task force may have recognized that this is not the same thing as authentic social value. When Philip Morris's senior executives cannot identify the company's contribution to societal welfare, it seems that there is no real argument for the continued existence of the tobacco industry in its current form. And this opens up opportunities to consider alternatives, including various endgame scenarios suggested by tobacco control advocates. These include incentivizing tobacco companies to reduce demand for their products or gradually phasing out smoked tobacco products by making cigarettes non-addictive or ending tobacco sales for those born after a certain date. these scenarios would enable potentially a tobacco company to contribute authentic social value. So I'll conclude by revisiting the big why question, asking it in a slightly different form. Why should society continue to sanction companies that create no social value and create so much harm for so many in the process of creating profits for so few? Thank you.